You are listening to Viva and Barnes, Law for the People. I am Viva Fry, David Fryheit, a Montreal litigator turned YouTuber. Robert Barnes is a world-renowned American civil rights attorney. In each podcast, we are going to break down and explain things that are going on in the legal world around us in terms that can be understood by everyone. The audio is pulled directly from our weekly live streams on YouTube, where you can find us on my channel, Viva Fry. And although the audio is not perfect when it comes to knowledge, knowledge is more important than audio quality. Enjoy your podcast. Robert, how you doing?
Good, good.
Okay, so I've had my moments. I think I'm actually red with. It's stupid, but I feel like an idiot because my mic was sitting at the corner of the table, not in front of my face as usual. Robert, what's the good word with you? You're at home in Vegas or in Nevada?
Yes, yes. Still here in Las Vegas. Been here for, I guess, whatever it is, week and a half, something like that, since being on the road. But yeah, I've done some work here for different people from here, but yeah, still here.
Okay. And I guess we're going to get into a lot of it. Where do we start? Let's start with the easiest one, Project Veritas. It's a fun discussion. And that way, when we get to the stuff that I haven't been able to do my homework on, you can carry the conversation. So for anybody who doesn't know, James O'Keefe, investigative journalist, or depending on who you ask, extreme right-wing propagandist, James O'Keefe does the investigative journalism that I grew up watching on 60 Minutes, undercover stuff, recording conversations, actual news. His target is mainstream media because of their anti-Trump left-wing bias. To my knowledge, you know, he's never done anything outright wrong. There was one story about him editing in him dressed like a pimp in one of the videos way back in the day about Acorn. I don't know about that. Although if that's true, you know, maybe he learned from his mistakes, but by and large recently, accurate reporting. Apparently, he had either the dial-in code to the editorial meetings at CNN for the last couple of months, or he had someone from the inside recording. We don't know the details, but we know that he dialed into the conference call this morning or yesterday, live streamed it saying, you know, I've recorded all of these meetings for the last 2 months, tongue-in-cheek jabbing Zucker, saying, do you still consider yourself to be the most trusted name in news? And I'm going to be releasing these recordings over the month of December. CNN goes to Twitter and says, we've advised law enforcement, you may have committed a felony. So I presume, Robert, they are alluding to the single party or two party consent state where, for those of you who don't know, if you are ever about to record a conversation or make a video, double check if you are in a one party or two party consent state. If you're in a two party consent state, everybody who's a party to that meeting has to consent to the recording. One party means that if you are a party or have permission of one of the parties, you can record. From what I understand, under no circumstances can you eavesdrop and wiretap without a warrant into a conversation in which you're not a party. I think that's the good overview. Do you think that's the angle that CNN is getting at with this accusation threat?
I don't know why they're making that. They're assuming, I guess, that nobody gave him authority that was a party, because Georgia's a one-party state. You can almost guarantee. He has not been – Project Veritas, to my knowledge, has never been successfully sued. And they have received more retractions and corrections from others in making accusations about them than any independent investigative journalist or media organization in the country. I think it currently runs 345 retractions that they have on their hall of retraction, their hall of fame, hall of shame for journalists. So a lot of accusations are made about them, but most of those people end up having to retract or correct those. And so he's also very, you know, has a lot of lawyers involved in advising him all the way through the process. So there's almost no chance he did anything illegal. So the CNN is just fishing and hoping. What they're really trying to do is out whoever it was that gave him authority that was in that meeting.
Well, there's that. And knowing what I know now and being cynical and jaded, are, you know, weaponizing the prosecutorial process, and maybe he did nothing wrong, but get the law enforcement after him with whatever inconveniences that entails. Two things. Well, the one thing about the retractions, I saw their wall of retractions. Some are good retractions and others are sort of, you know, they would, if there's a wall of retraction shame, they would have smaller portions on it than others. But the question about the two-party, one-party consent state, Georgia's a one-party consent state. If it were New York, New York's a one-party consent state as well. The issue would become if there were multiple parties to the suit and some of whom were either on a conference call in a two-party consent state, technically then you could have an issue?
No, generally not. Because the if it's a call between states, one party rules the rule. So the so you have to, if the call is being made from a two-party state where everybody on the call is a two-party state, then the two-party rule applies. But generally, no two-party rule has to apply unless everybody on the call is in a two-party state, is the usual protocol.
Okay, so it's an amazing thing. We'll see where it goes. I thought the threat was a blank of a threat, almost sort of, I would say, an embarrassment to people who know the law, a stretch to people who might have a limited understanding of the law. Okay, that's very interesting. That about covers it. I don't think there's any legal nuance to that. The one thing I was wondering, I suspect it might have been the insider who was doing the recording in any event and not even James O'Keefe as an outsider, in which case there's no case whatsoever. As to what he did when he live streamed, could that qualify as a felony if it's a two-party consent state? I mean, they're based in Georgia, but they have offices in New York. So I don't know.
Both of those states are one-party states. So the core of it is what it all comes down to a certain degree, is do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the call? And so if you're in a one-party state, or you know people who are listening in a one-party state, can you say you have a reasonable expectation that no one's recording unless everyone had prior consent? Probably not. So I think that they're fishing on that. I think it was just a punitive reaction of anger and pique because they got exposed again because he's been able to infiltrate them so easily, so consistently. It has agitated them to a great degree.
Now, innocently, like they're doing a conference call. They know someone might be recording it. They might be recording it themselves. But we saw this with Emmett Sullivan in the Flynn hearing, where they aired on the internet, but said that nobody could reproduce it under penalty of contempt or something.
Right. That's just because it's a judicial rule. Because the theory is that they're allowing for public access, but not recording. And so that when you're listening live, that's public access. Anything else is recording. And that's just because it's a judicial process that's subject to judicial rules. There's no universal law on that whatsoever. I mean, you'd have to allege copyright or something like that. You can't really allege that in a conversation in most cases.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what comes out of this then. But yeah, I thought it was sort of not a shot in the dark, but just a shot of desperation. Maxim Perkinkov said, "What is the sixth letter of the alphabet?" in a super chat I missed a while back. Okay. What do we do now? Well, let's start with the big one. Do we start with the judgment coming out of Wisconsin today, or do we start with the judgment coming out of Georgia on Friday on the Powell lawsuits?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of them. I mean, probably the best news is that the Arizona election contest filed by Kelly Ward, and I was helping draft a comparable contest at the time, and she ended up filing and focusing on the issues we wanted to have focused on. So I did have some role in that. But she was able to get a court to order, as is the right to inspect ballots in the state of Arizona if you file an election contest, was able to get the court to order the first required signature match check. Now, it was just a sample, not all the ballots, but also allow a review of duplicate ballots, which was a particular concern in Arizona. There are other concerns in Arizona by the president's 46-minute speech today from the White House, where he went through all the different details in all the key states and laid out why he was going to continue to contest the election and wasn't going to just go gently into that good night. Because, for example, there are a bunch of people, as Steven Crowder is talking about, that came from Matt Brainerd's testimony in the Arizona hearing. Because I think we had the Arizona hearings on Monday after we had the Pennsylvania hearings last Friday or Thursday. And then we had the Michigan hearings yesterday, and I guess there's some going on today.
And now people are going to take issue with the term hearings. We're talking about the Giuliani hearings before the legislature, not court hearings.
Depends. Right. Yes. Yes. For the nature of these hearings, some are being conducted outside the context of the legislature, but being done by legislators. So they're basically public hearings. And then you have the in Michigan, they're doing the hearings within the legislature. So Pennsylvania and Arizona hearings outside, public hearings by legislators, Michigan legislative hearings, no evidentiary hearing other than the one state Michigan court, and that was sort of an abbreviated one, has really been conducted yet anywhere. And the election contest cases just got started. So the one that got started in Arizona, they the first substantive relief, the right to inspect ballots with that was ordered. Now, it's a small sample size. I would have liked a bigger sample size. But even in the small, so far, they've just been through the duplicates. And these are duplicate ballots that get printed for a whole bunch of reasons. There's issues with that. But putting that aside, anytime you have duplicate ballots, you have a risk of double counting of ballots. But they found about a 2% error rate. In other words, ballots that should have counted for Trump that were not counted, just in, I think, the 200 duplicate sample size they were given. Well, that's five times greater than the margin of victory in Arizona in terms of percentages. So they've already established that factual foundation for the election contest to move forward in Arizona. And now the question is, do they, when they look at the signatures, do they also find a mismatch? We don't know how they picked the subsample, because that's a big key part. You know, you can obviously pick samples that look a lot better than others. So is it a true random sample or is it a little bit selective sampling? We'll see. The testimony presented in Arizona was much like that presented in Pennsylvania. Same with Michigan. I think from a court of public opinion perspective, these public hearings have been highly successful. The only response you've seen from the left is not to, for the most part, is not to refute the allegations. They've sometimes refuted certain allegations about technology claims and statistical anomalies, but the substantive claims they have not refuted. Like when someone says, "I was a provisional ballot clerk in Arizona on election night. I was told by the election official in charge to accept ballots that were not legally processed by people who are not registered voters." I've seen no answer from the press on that. I've seen no answer from the left. Instead, the only answer is, well, that doesn't count because their sworn testimony was at a public hearing, not a court hearing.
I mean, I don't
have sufficient evidence.
I put that out in today's video. You know, some of the responses I got, I asked Brian Stetler a question. I don't expect him to ever answer, but did you even watch the hearings? It was almost like someone said, this is the response. Everyone use it. Why would I watch those hearings? To watch them would be to give credence to illegitimate kangaroo courts. No, they weren't hearings. They weren't hearings. Okay. The one question is, what is what is the difference then between the hearing in the Hyatt and a hearing before the legislature? Are there any more? I mean, I guess there's penalties of perjury before the legislature where there wouldn't be if it's in a hotel. Any like actual
not protocol? Necessarily, because my understanding is all these people were testifying under a penalty of perjury anyway. So the you need is someone to give the oath. So frankly, the only difference is the surrounding. You know, it's how nice the chairs are. How nice is the walls? I mean, that's about it. Public hearing. I mean, we routinely do public hearings. The Kefauver hearings concerning the mob exposing massive corruption in the United States were almost all public hearings, not held in D.C. There are some famously held here in Las Vegas where the mob museum is, where they've actually kept the actual room that was used. So public hearings are a regular procedure to be used by legislators to develop evidence for a record. It doesn't have to be part of a formal legislative hearing for that to happen. In fact, if anything, they're under more scrutiny because a legislator probably can be sued for something they say in a public hearing in a way they can't be for something at a legislative hearing. So if anything, they have more obligation to tell the truth rather than less, because state legislators are not given the same immunity that Elizabeth Warren was given in the Covington case. So and we'll see if that's sustainable. But yeah, so that attack is not really the most credible attack at all. I mean, all of the attacks I've heard so far are attacks from power, not attacks from principle. They're all, hey, the people that have power, the elected officials, the Congress members, the leaders of the state legislature, the judges, they've all said, screw you. We don't care. So that somehow is an argument. To me, that's just not an argument. I mean, the way I responded is, you know, Martin Luther King had a losing record in court. Do we really consider that a testament to him, or do we consider that a testament to how bad the courts were?
Well, and we're going to get into that because specifically with one of the Sidney Powell decisions, which I say is whether or not the judge had legitimate points, you can see judges jabbing people that they don't like judicially. Someone asked, where can we go to see the evidence? Robert, what was the website that that the locals community put up?
Hereistheevidence.com. I had it pinned up. I may pin it up again on our locals board. For those that don't know, that's vivabarneslaw.locals.com. But the locals guy established it. In fact, he needs people to either help out or provide some people who want to advertise on his site because he's getting hammered with the number of views. And then everybody's got demands. They're like, you know, it's amazing. This guy, he's on our locals board. He crowdfunds this great research and work. And people are like, could you organize it this way? Could you also do this? Could you also do that? You know, God bless. It's like, okay, you know, volunteer then or get advertising for him or something like that so that, you know, he's just not swamped working for free all the time.
People, it's an amazing thing. People don't necessarily appreciate that this takes a lot of time. People don't regard this as a real job or as a real thing because it's sometimes if you just do it online, it's
you could do that video in like 15 seconds, huh?
it's 1 in 100 at most, but it's always those some comments irritate you more than others. Okay, so hereistheevidence.com. I put it in there. I don't know if it's going to be a hyperlink, and that's where people can go. I'm noticing the most obvious refutation or refuting of the evidence is absolutely ignoring it and not reporting on it. People don't go to look at it.
It's purely who is the decision maker. It's what is the setting in which the evidence is presented. That's it. No qualitative answers. Like the only answers I've got back on signature match checks are either fake news. Somebody says, oh, those signature matches were already independently confirmed and independently monitored. I'm like, no, they were not. They were not anywhere. It's like just because Brad Heath, the legal news reporter at Reuters, used to be at USA Today, is gaslighting you about that doesn't make it true. Their willingness, and that tells you if they didn't see that as a soft point, as a point of vulnerability, the fact they've never allowed independently monitored signature matches, they wouldn't feel the need to lie about that that having already occurred. It's usually you can tell by the quality of someone's response whether or not you really hit a nerve or not. And the quality of the response has been very poor for the most part. I mean, where they've been strong is arguments related to the technology and certain kinds of statistical evidence they can refute pretty effectively. They have not been able to refute the signature match issues or all the testimony about unusual ballots being transported from different places, unusual ballot counting occurring at key times. Most of that they've had to lie about rather than answer.
I just want to read this one because it's an interesting comment. Salome Baptiste Smith says, dual citizen French and U.S. New York City resident, but living in Paris this year, did not receive my absentee ballot, was offered an email form with no privacy. This seems to have been common in New York. First I've heard of it.
Yeah, New York, Illinois, and California were just kind of a joke. I mean, they were the most egregious forms of it. And what's fascinating is, you know, how did Trump, the New York City precincts apparently have finally finished. It's not clear they've really finished, but somehow the New York City precincts, Trump did better in all of them, but he did 20 points weaker in Atlanta. I mean, this has never happened before, that kind of anomaly. So there are some, the statistical anomalies keep accumulating. They're not diminishing. I can see why they were anxious to rush Trump into concession, because it's clear that as people dig, more keeps popping up, not less. Trump stumbled onto a zombie field of evidence.
This is the thing where in the dynamic and the interplay of all of the various arguments, you know, you have taken your issue with some arguments being raised and publicized that detract from the other ones. And this sort of works to segue into A.G. Barr's statement or interview yesterday or the day before, no widespread voter fraud that would affect the outcome of the election, which I just put a video out today, is a very interesting way of explaining it, because to say that there is no widespread voter fraud that would have otherwise affected the outcome of the election, it's I'm not playing with semantics and I'm not building strawman arguments. It necessarily means there was a certain degree, if not recognized, widespread voter fraud, but that they've made the determination it wouldn't affect the outcome, because otherwise you just don't phrase it like that. You say there was no voter fraud that would have affected the outcome, not no widespread voter fraud that would have affected the outcome. And it seems like you've mentioned it before that it's such a big problem And that it's a problem. It's sort of like the best kept secret in Washington that nobody wants to solve it. And so you have AG Barr, to some extent, sort of sweeping it under the rug or kicking it down the line to a different court, saying, regardless, this is not a DOJ issue. This is a civil lawsuit issue. But we've found some fraud. We just trust us. It's not big enough to affect the outcome when the outcome is, you know, under 1% in five states, which affects everything. So, I mean, the absentee ballot issue is a new problem to some extent. It's the first time it's ever occurred in an election to this extent.
And he himself just 2 months ago said it was going to be it was an invitation towards mass fraud. So the I took it as two different things. As your video explained, the media deliberately misinterpreted what he said because he had three hedges there. His first hedge was to date we haven't found. So he was not ruling out finding it later. And then secondly, said, as you note, widespread voter fraud. Third, that caused the election to flip. And so he was, you know, he had all these hedges built in. Now, my problem with Barr saying anything is Barr knew exactly how the media would interpret his statements. So Barr's not unsophisticated. He's very familiar with how this works. And notice what happened. So on Monday, Trump has a successful hearings in Arizona where independent people watching it or people that were willing to be persuaded either way. I mean, my view is you have about a quarter to a third of Trump's base that will always believe the election was stolen and are looking for confirmation bias. So they're just looking for evidence or arguments that are what they want to hear. That's a lot of people that are in the Powell Wood camp. So no matter what is said, no matter how challengeable or contestable it may be or how evidence-free it may be, they're jumping on it and running with it no matter what, because it's what they want to hear. It's the nature of confirmation bias. It's like the Russiagators of the left. But then the other two-thirds, I think, are really open to persuasion. You know, maybe it had happened, maybe it didn't. They might lean in one direction or the other. But that group was all very persuaded by what they saw in Pennsylvania and then was also persuaded again by what they saw in Arizona. And so what happens? The same Republican governor that just a few days before had said he would not be certifying the election until the litigation issues are resolved. And by this point, he knew the head of the Republican Party, Kelly Ward, in Arizona had filed an election contest and was reviewing evidence. He rushes to certify the election. So this is the Republican establishment pushing back on Trump, trying to step on any success of Trump. The very next day, you have the Tuesday hearings in Michigan, and suddenly Barr feels the compelling need to just start yipping to the press about clearly it's a joke at this stage. He hasn't done any investigation. The FBI hasn't done any investigation. They haven't even talked to 90% of the witnesses. So it's a crock for him to say he's investigated anything. All he was going to do was remind people who had wanted to believe in him that they were wrong to believe in him. That's all he did. But he's protecting the establishment, and I'm sure he'll get a nice cushy gig when he gets done.
Well, so there's two ways of looking at this. Some people are saying, my initial reaction was Barr sees the writing on the wall. He's trying to get in bed with the new establishments and, you know, and not be cut on day one. Other people are going to say it's a distraction. They're doing something else behind the scenes while Barr, shows a shiny coin to the media. There's no positive spin on what Barr has said, except for the way it ought to be interpreted, in that the amount of qualifiers in the statement necessarily imply, and they mean that they found something, but they're just trying to reassure you. The same people, someone said this, who went after Carter Page for years, who falsified documents, that same party now, that same entity is telling you, yeah, we found fraud, but trust us, it wouldn't have affected the outcome, where the outcome was, you know, the difference was under 1% in five states. So there's no positive spin to it, but for the fact the way in which it should be read. And it does mean that the DOJ and the FBI are really not doing anything to look into this in any meaningful sense.
Yeah, no, I mean, they only talked to Matt Brainerd a few days ago after Brainerd got a lot of attention. And it's because Brainerd's allegations are very concrete. The only allegations Barr took explicit pot shots at were Sidney Powell's allegations. So that was it. And to say that nothing like that is present, nothing like that is here, I didn't mind him saying that to a certain degree, because it made clear that, you know, people who think there's been servers seized in Germany, well, apparently it's news to Barr if that happened. So that gives anybody, I gave him credit for being honest and saying, we're not going to be helping you out any. Well, the FBI's not going to be coming to your rescue. The Justice Department's not going to be coming to your rescue. I mean, that's what he basically said. I mean, he just shouldn't have added the ancillary of we've investigated and that there's no consequential fraud here that we can find to date. He should have just said, if he's honest, we have done no investigation. We plan on doing no investigation. So don't rely on us for any investigation. That would have been an honest Barr statement. But yeah, the but it was evidence that he's not. And then he also at the same time released the fact that he had put Durham under special counsel.
No, and wait for the jokes, Barnes, to kick in the comment section.
Yes, yes, indeed.
It's I mean, I read it. It gives the soundbite everybody needed that the media wanted to distract from everything else that's going on. But even the reference to the disguised reference to Sidney Powell's lawsuits, I have an issue with as well, in the sense that it's true. 2 months ago, 3 months ago, he was the biggest liar on earth to the media when he was saying that this is rife, that this is fraught fraud.
Both ripe and rife. It's ripe for rife fraud.
So he was the biggest liar in the world, and now he's the savior again. And I forget, It was this Marshall Cohen from CNN who said Barr lying in December, whatever, what month was it? The summer.
July.
Lying then when he said there was risk. Telling the truth now. It's lacking self-awareness, confirmation bias, but the fact that they could say, when you have an electronic server, that we're not even going to look into it, notwithstanding the history, notwithstanding the old footage that's coming up now of CNN 10 years ago, or maybe more, 14 years ago, having done its own expose on the risks of these machines, making a lot of the same allegations Sidney Powell is now making, but nothing to look into because it's 10 years later and it's still the same machine. It's bizarre. It's peculiar. I think definitely the more plausible interpretation is Barr is trying to cozy up to the new administration and or just not let too many dirty secrets out, because there's only one person who benefits from that, whereas everybody benefits from the status quo to some extent.
Yeah, he's an institutionalist coming to the defense of the institutions. It turned out he, back in October, made Durham special counsel. People are allocating to that power that I don't quite see, because I don't see why Biden's attorney general can't come in and fire him. I mean, that's basically what Barr did. Barr told Mueller to shut it down. So he's not an independent counsel, so he's not separated from the control of the attorney general to do whatever they want. So unless I've missed something in the analysis, I didn't see great significance to that. It just required overt action of the new attorney general to shut him down. And that's all. It doesn't require anything else. And anyone who doesn't think that he will, all right. I mean, put it this way, if he doesn't shut him down, then he knows what a complete joke Durham is anyway. So if Durham poses an actual threat, they'll shut him down. If Durham does not pose an actual threat, then they'll let him, you know, issue his little report a year from now or whenever it happens. I didn't take that as a Barr compliment. And you saw Trump be critical of it today in his 46-minute speech. He put the plot against the election in the context of the plot against the president. From both the book by Lee Smith and the documentary movie by Adam Milius, whose father's a famous director. She was very nice to me when I was in D.C., when she was at the State Department for a good period of time. There are many Trump loyalists up there that tried to get power. But, you know, the reason why she left was the same reason others never got that power. I mean, that's why we're here. But Trump went out of his way to say, you know, yeah, they could harass me for 4 years, but somehow Durham couldn't get a simple report done. He was overt about it. And, you know, so, you know, he gave Barr the Riot Act yesterday.
Well, and what I love in a cynical sense is they spent 2-3 years with the Mueller report investigating the alleged Russia collusion. And there's not even so much as, you know, Bill Barr says we're running down some leads, but we know darn well what they have not investigated, but they found 3 years for the Russia collusion. And it's not to say I wasn't buying into the Russia collusion at the time, but you follow the report, you follow the investigation. to say that they investigated that with, you know, scrutinizing everything for 3 years, but this just push it by, make sure it's the inauguration day and people will forget, it lacks credibility.
And my guess is, given the timing, like people thought Trump called Barr over. I suspect it was the other way around yesterday. I suspect that Barr thought he could step on this. All the establishment has believed that they could just push back against Trump and he would capitulate. I don't know why they thought that, given who he is. But it was clear when I was in Georgia, they thought that Trump's own lawyers thought they could force him into capitulation. The lawyers really secretly working, had a conflict working for the Secretary of State's office, were complicit in the signature match problems in that the consent decree they signed with a Stacey Abrams back group. So I think their whole game plan all along has been, we'll just force him to fold at the key juncture. We'll force him to fold. The media pressure, our internal pressure, when he sees no allies in the judiciary, no allies in the Senate, no allies in the state legislatures of power and influence, and those the state legislative leaders, majority leaders and whatnot, that when he sees that, he'll just capitulate. And I think Trump pushed back against Barr in person yesterday, and that's why he came out, decided to do his speech today. So that, like, you know, this has been a four-year effort to undermine me and four-year effort to break the law to rig an election, and try to cast a shadow on the last one. And so I'm not going anywhere until we get a meaningful, free, open, transparent election process. And I think that the people who thought he was going to go away are just not, they're just in la la land. Now, he's not doing what the revival rally that Lynn Wood and Sidney Powell had in Georgia. That's a nice.
It's a good segue, because I don't understand the impact of that. And it'll be a good way to, we'll talk about the recent developments in the Sidney Powell Linwood lawsuits and then that rally. So which one do we start with? It was in Wisconsin that for what it's worth, the Barack Obama appointed judge chewed L. Linwood and Sidney Powell out, but proper as far as judicial chewing outs go. And for anybody who wants to get a taste for the practice and how annoying and soul crushing it is, if a judge doesn't like you, they're going to pick on your silly mistakes to make you look stupid in front of the court, and in this case, in front of the general public. So this judge issued an order today. I don't actually fully appreciate what the purpose of the order was, other than just to notify the parties of deficiencies in their pleadings. But the judge basically said, your complaint was not verified, which I take to mean sworn in, which it was a procedural requirement for injunctive relief. You didn't ask for a hearing date. You asked for an emergency, an expedited process, but didn't explain why. You didn't file the first lawsuit, or you didn't serve the first version of the lawsuit. And then you said you were going to file some documents that were not attached to the lawsuit. The order basically nitpicked at everything that was improperly done on a procedural level in the lawsuit. Also just basically saying you didn't ask for a hearing. So now the defendants have, 20 days or something to file a contestation, which effectively makes the proceedings irrelevant because it's going to go past the required time. It's the ugly side of law, where the judge can embarrass you and will embarrass you if they want to, and you give them an opportunity. I'm inclined to be very forgiving on Wood and Powell, because they're drafting a tremendous amount of proceedings. They have, I don't know how the size of the team, but it's just, you will have mistakes like this that you can remedy otherwise without being publicly humiliated, which is what the judge set out to do. What's going to be the impact of that order? What are they going to do to remedy these proceedings? And are they beyond remedy?
You know, I don't know quite what their collective objective is, because a similar problem happened in Georgia. Once they got a temporary restraining order, they didn't get all of what they wanted, and so they appealed it, even though generally you don't appeal a temporary restraining order. It deprives the court of jurisdiction, so the court can't hold a hearing on an expedited basis. And that judge made that point because he was one of the few judges that was willing to, you know, hear them out, give them a fair hearing. So when you're spoiling the relationships with good judges, you know what's going to happen with the bad ones. So the judges are seeing that they can start to greenlight each other's harsher and escalating criticism. So, you know, they did make basic mistakes. They referenced wanting to make sure all the security cameras in Detroit were safe in a case filed in Wisconsin. They had a plaintiff who turned out wasn't a plaintiff, said he had no idea he was a named plaintiff in the case. These are like core mistakes. And so I'm seeing a rush to file suits that are often very big and very complicated and very complex that don't incorporate skilled local lawyers that are experienced litigators in those courtrooms. I could have told you about the Wisconsin judge in particular, that once you drew her, you needed to do certain things. Let's just say she's the female Judge Sullivan. I may have cases in front of her, so I got to be diplomatic, but everyone else will know what I mean. The I've gone to bat with battle, overt battle. I had a federal judge in the Eastern District of Wisconsin cuss at me repeatedly. Now, it turned out useful because I got him recused from a future case I needed him recused from. But he fixed a jury pool in my case, so I'm still bitter at him. But, yeah, so, I mean, you got some interesting judges there. I wouldn't be in the Eastern District of Wisconsin if I could avoid it. Now, Western District's not exactly like light years better, but there's at least one or two okay. Again, at this point, I would go to state court. You're not going to get relief from federal court in all likelihood.
People need to appreciate that some people will view something as confidence versus arrogance depending on their overall perspective of the situation. You're not giving them a hard time for the sake of giving them a hard time. These are legitimate issues that people have to appreciate. Strategic issues. It is always easier for those who are not involved in doing the work to not make mistakes because they're not doing the work. But it doesn't mean that you hold back and don't state what you think is, you know, objective problems, mistakes, and strategy. And also being harsh on them for procedural issues, for cut and paste errors, which are obviously the case when you reference servers in a different state in another state lawsuit. These things happen. So they're not ideal, but this is not a question of giving them a hard time just to, you know, to sit back and say, look how easy it is for everyone to pick on their typos. One thing we should clarify, the temporary restraining order that they got in Georgia, which was a 10-day temporary restraining order. I think it was 10 days, which is what they are. TROs, they're like provisional injunctions from what I understand in Canada. They last until the hearing on the temporary injunction or the interlocutory injunction. They're only supposed to last the bare minimum to prevent the irreparable harm on an urgent basis. You get to the longer term injunction afterwards. So they got an order from the court enjoining the destruction or the reformatting or the seizing of the voting machines. I didn't appreciate this nuance. They appealed that decision because I guess they wanted more, but explain that in so appealing the TRO, temporary restraining order in Georgia, the court loses jurisdiction. And what happens to that TRO that was issued?
The TRO stays in place, but the Court of Appeals can of course expand it or reverse it. But the problem is twofold. One, you're giving the 11th Circuit a chance to invalidate it and gut your case, which is where they're likely to go if you understand the 11th Circuit in these kind of cases. Remember, the 11th Circuit didn't even give relief to Bush and Bush v. Gore. So the predecessor parallel versions of that that went up through the federal court system. And then secondly, you just had another federal judge citing 11th Circuit precedent just tell Lynn Wood that he doesn't have standing to sue. And the same claim is going to be made here. Here you get a judge willing to grant you temporary relief out of the gate without that. And he even went further than he needed. He had to, like, initially gave relief. Then the state made clear, hey, by the way, these parties aren't even parties. And so he pulled back the relief. And then he gave a third order that said, well, I think I can go this far. So he went beyond the call of duty, which is going to be hard for any federal judge to do in an election contest. And they reward him by saying you should have gone further. And by taking it up to the 11th Circuit, they basically means the hearing that's scheduled for Friday can't happen. Unless the 11th Circuit rules before then, because he doesn't have jurisdiction while it's pending in the 11th Circuit. So that's why he wrote a more delicate ruling. He didn't take any pot shot. I mean, here they made more mistakes in that filing in terms of like spelling errors, typos, incorrect references, you name it. He didn't say anything about any of it. So he's going out of his way not to take shots at him, and he's going out of his way to give them relief wherever he thinks he can. And their response was to whack him and take him up to the appeals where they're not likely to win at all. And he just made that point in a very sort of real gentle order. He said, by the way, I can't really do a hearing on Friday because you guys chose to appeal it. And by the way, there usually isn't a right to appeal a temporary restraining order. I mean, he could have said that a lot harsher. So they're put it this way. The critics that see this as a big grift, who think they're just filing suits to look good but don't plan on being able to actually win, but want to make it look like they fought hard and then say the judicial system was corrupt, they're doing the kind of things that keep reinforcing that. So I don't think that's actually their objective, but they're doing the things that it's harder and harder for me to argue to those others, to that other side, in defense of these cases, given these. Now, my view is this is the product of not having election lawyers, not having skilled lawyers who know that local area. And by the way, they were told this before they filed these suits. So this isn't quarterback second overnight, Monday night quarterbacking, as I think the phrase
Monday
is.
Monday morning.
That's it. Monday morning quarterbacking. It isn't Monday morning quarterbacking. They were told this before. They were told this. They needed these people involved before. They suggest, people had suggested to them their role probably shouldn't be lead litigator role. They didn't like hearing that. And so they marched on forward. So and then you get today's show, where Lynn Wood appears to be trying to imitate Donald Trump. He almost thinks he is Donald Trump. I mean, he's wearing the hat. He's got the red tie. He's got the overcoat that Trump likes to wear in the cold. He's doing his revival speech, walking back and forth and doing this. And he's burning down every bridge left in Georgia. And I get the hardcore Trump base laps that up. That's not a good court of public opinion, appealing to legislators or appealing to Congress members. That's a establish a record for the future argument. That is not an argument to win now. That's an argument, in fact, to lose now.
Well, and that's so I don't necessarily fully appreciate the impact or the scope of this. They had, from what I saw, 400,000 people watching online, which is impressive. I mean, monumental. And
that was just one streamer. I'm sure millions watched.
So you have, let's just say you have at the very least 500,000, probably over 1 million people watching. They are calling for a boycott of the Georgia elections. If that happens, you get two Dems getting seats in the Senate, which gives the Dems a majority or a tie in the Senate, which can have disastrous impacts from a policy perspective. If you're not a Democrat, can have wonderful consequences if you are a Democrat. But what do you make of the fact that so many people are watching this, tuning into it? Is it going to have an impact on the Georgia election?
I think it's two things. Both of them, Powell and Wood, have done a good job promoting their pitch by coming up with the most dramatic, craziest story. They drew the most attention. Trump did this in 2016. He always took the hardest position to get the most attention on something to outmaneuver his adversaries. So I'm not just going to ban people. I'm going to ban all Muslims from coming into the country. I mean, he did actually say that at one point. That wasn't the order he ultimately signed, but he did it for political reasons. He knew, he's like, I bet this will dominate. So Scott Adams explained this well, and it fits within certain psychologies. So they have adopted the most extreme positions, and from it, they have got the most attention and most validation. Even though they are the least experienced in election law, they are the least educated in how elections actually function, and they've been making claims that those of us familiar with these elections and election law have found highly questionable and unlikely to be proven, and often undermining the president's position in the court of law and in the courts of politicians and the courts of Congress, likely helping him with the court of public opinion. I mean, there's a reason why Russiagate will always be believed by at least a half of the left. You'll never convince them that Trump wasn't secretly colluding with the Russians to steal and hack the election. They'll believe that, we will have a portion of the right that will believe that, the reverse version of that for this election. And I understand that. That's naturally appealing to us. The easiest thing to do, if my goal was to raise money or raise notoriety, then the way to go is, hey, the computers did it with the Chinese, with the Venezuelans, and all the enemies of Trump conspire together, and they magically put 5 to 6% of the vote everywhere. And even though statistical evidence would refute me, even though documentary evidence would not support me, even though testimonial evidence would not back me up, I would not care, because I would know that a portion of the audience doesn't care about that. If that was my objective. And I'm not saying that was their objective. I think they really believe that the ship they've gone sailing on, but I don't think it's a ship that's warranted in evidence or will be proven in time. And they haven't behaved like people trying to actually win. They behave like people trying to win in the court of public opinion. I mean, Lynn Wood is calling for federal martial law.
Okay.
This is not sane behavior, folks.
Well, so someone had asked that, let me get the super chat while we're on it, because It was Maria. No, it wasn't that. Oh, who was it? Can Trump? Okay, here we go. Jessica Cora, early on Super Chat. Can Trump use the Insurrection Act and the NSPD 51, I don't know what that is, to void all federal elections for national security and hold a new election administered solely by the military under martial law? The case has been made.
One, that's a terrible idea. If you wanted to have the, if you wanted to completely discredit Trump, do that. Or try to do that. By the way, it wouldn't happen. But just try to say, because then he looks like a crazy, all the caricatures of him then look true. He's the dictator who wants to use military control, who doesn't, won't honor democratic limits, who won't honor democratic restraints, won't honor democratic elections. That is exactly the wrong path to pursue. And by the way, the military, there is zero chance they would go along with him. So that's why that, as soon as he started going down that lunatic path, this is what happens when you live in QAnon world. Sorry, QAnon folks. And remember, if you hate me, you can go to Locals, vivabarneslaw.locals.com, and if you become a subscriber, I'll actually read your trolling comments. But that's the only place you're guaranteed for me to read them.
We're gonna have a new ticking, running ticker in all of our streams: is first movie reference, first book reference, and first time Robert gets on QAnon's case. People think you spend too much time on it, but you have your reasons, and I'm not one to criticize.
Because this is where it leads to. This is how do you get someone who a year ago was considered a very serious lawyer, who 2 weeks ago was being given a lot of credibility in this legal, such that 500,000 people on just one streaming channel are watching him live, get to the point where he thinks it's a good idea to tell the president of the United States to disband the country and form military control and have martial law. There's no scenario in which that's a good idea, folks. But when you get into that world, you start to believe things that are not credible, and you have a echo chamber that repeats crazy ideas and reinforces your crazy ideas, to where you get up and you're starting to talk about, we're going to walk around Jericho and the walls of Jericho will fall. And look, and for those who have any doubt about it, I grew up in the Baptist tradition. I grew up in revival churches here, and that, you know, those versions of, you know, I'm all fine with all that. But there's a difference between utilizing it in an appropriate setting and time where it'd be politically effective, and sounding like you're part of a something out of a Escape from L.A. movie character. That you're that kind of would-be presidential candidate supporter. You know, you don't want to look like that. That's what his critics. And notice Trump pushed back against that today. He let them speak, and then he goes out and does his and he does none of that nonsense. He says, all I want is an honest election. The American people deserve an honest election. Please let's count the signatures, and please let's make sure illegal votes don't count. That's it. And he goes, he said what he told me. I don't care if I lost an election, as long as I lost it fair and square. But I want to know, was it fair and square? And aren't the American people entitled to know? And he didn't push any of this martial law. Let's have the military take over the country. Let's have new elections with the military guarding the gates. None of this. This is what happens when you're in an echo chamber that talks about people secretly being down at Gitmo, and Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are about to get arrested tomorrow. When you start living that world and you think it's true, you say things as crazy as what Lynn Wood said that are self-discrediting, that the left had a field day making fun of today, because they say, here's the people telling you there's a problem with the election. People that are talking about bringing down Jericho, and people that are telling you that the Gitmo is being active and the military is coming to run the country. This is not who you want vouching for you, folks.
And I think everybody just needs to appreciate that. The idea of declaring martial law, I mean, like you say, it is the embodiment of the dictator refusing to accept it. It would be depicted as North Korea. I know people believe that it's the only alternative right now because the system is so broken, but it would be the worst possible solution that would not yield the result that people want it to yield. And I'm reading some of the comments. Some people disagree and think the military is on Trump's side, but it cannot be a military solution to this without reaffirming the exact dictatorial accusations that have been leveled against Trump and his supporters for the last 4 years.
And look at any nation that has relied upon military control and rule, and ask yourself whether that's ever turned out good long term. That's never turned out good long term. There's no example where the military temporarily took over for any purpose that didn't mean the military didn't run your life and time. and they'll be happy. And the idea that the high ranking military, what part of Mattis admitting now he had conversations while he was Secretary of Defense with the Director of National Intelligence to do a coup against the president? I mean, he admitted those kind of conversations. Do people still think the high ranking people in the military are on the Trump populist side? They have never been. They've just admitted that they lied to the president for 4 years about the troop presence in Syria so that they didn't have to approve his orders to withdraw troops from there. So that's QAnon nonsense. That's what that is.
Now, where was it? It was J. Mill. Oh, am I going to be able to get to the comment? It was a question of whether or not there's enough time practically left to address the Brainerd. J. Mill says, is there enough time for the basic cases, including Brainerd's info and simple ballot stuffing, to cause a true forensic audit in a few of those states?
Yeah. What's happening right now in Arizona? I mean, they're going to have a hearing this week based on what they find. So they'll done a statistically significant, according to the court. And this is what I told folks everywhere. I said, look, let the court set what the statistically significant number is, because the court will actually establish a lower number than you may request. Make the court go on record first. Make it their idea. And they did that brilliantly in Arizona. So the court said, oh, you know, this number of ballots will tell us whether there's a problem. Well, okay, fine. It was a lot fewer than a lot of people would have compelled. Well, then Democrats or the governor would have said otherwise. The Secretary of State would have said otherwise. So now, but you have the judge already admitting it. If they look at those 200 signatures and they find two that don't appear to match, they've got five times more the number of questionable ballots than they need to overturn the election. And that's just Arizona. So there's plenty of time in these. If they do election contest and they don't get distracted by all of these sideshows, to absolutely get remedy in the courts where election contests are allowed. Now, again, you know, because they got sidetracked, I don't think the campaign ever even filed a correct one in Pennsylvania. But I do believe one did get filed anyway in Pennsylvania, because I may have drafted it. So I believe it did get filed. I know one's getting filed in Georgia. I know several of the people that follow us on the locals board, they went and filed themselves in Georgia. So there's election contest pending. And again, in almost all these states, they're supposed to give you an inspection of a sufficient sample size of ballots to determine a forensic audit to meet statistical significance standards for empirical evidence. And my view is, if anybody gets a chance at that in any of these states where its signatures are a key factor, then they're there. Trump is already there in Wisconsin, because the number of indefinitely confined people was way more than it was supposed to be legally. So you have over 100,000 ballots likely cast illegally in Wisconsin. That's five times more than the margin of victory. In Michigan now, they claim they have several hundred thousand ballots that were illegally cast because of the issues just out of Wayne County. In Pennsylvania, they have millions of ballots cast in violation of the Pennsylvania Constitution. So they have enough without the signatures. But I think if you add the signatures in Pennsylvania, Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia, there'll be an evidentiary hearing, I believe, tomorrow in Nevada about these issues. If they finally get a signature match check at all, then we'll find out. Now, maybe the signatures really all do match. Maybe that wasn't the source of an issue, but historical evidence would say that's extremely unlikely, and their own behavior would say that's unlikely. So there's plenty of time to incorporate Brainerd's evidence. It's up to whether courts allow it to happen, and whether legislators then take remedial action at either the state level or federal level, and that's where the court of public opinion matters. And it's good to rally the base. My point is, if you're rallying the base with stuff that the courts of law and the courts of Congress are going to ignore, then you're forfeiting that potential opportunity by pursuing that path. That's why Trump is not pursuing that path. The people pursuing that, in fact, he's refuting that repeatedly. I mean, within an hour of Powell's and Wood's statements, he put out a tweet. Not only did he put out his own statement going directly against what they were suggesting, he also put out a tweet saying, we're going to be supporting the Republican candidates for the Senate, because having Democrats control all three branches is not a solution to the problem of this election.
All right. On the subject, Christian Oliver says, is the talk about the 305th Battalion Cyber Task Force, known as the Kraken, monitoring CIA? And I think by and large,
it's false. That whole thing is false. When Powell started claiming that random people on the internet were supporting her version, she's had six different interpretations of the Kraken now. So I've just run out of patience with this. I mean, it's not been productive. It's not been true. She didn't even reach out to key people, by the way, on the data side until yesterday. So she got garbage evidence and she decided it was garbage evidence and moved forward with it. And as I see her blowing up these cases and making it easy for the law Twitter and the courts to start to mock these cases, I've lost patience with it. I mean, maybe it was a sincere effort. Maybe she meant well. She is backfiring and hurting the cause at this juncture.
Okay, now Groundhog asked the question that I have the same question. Now, do you believe Trump will flip any states? Which state flips first? And then the other question that I've been having is, if he successfully flips one state, is that going to create the momentum for the other contested states to consider flipping? And then let's go the one step further. If too many states start flipping, what's going to be the response from the other side who are going to say you're not respecting the will of the people?
Yeah, I mean, and what else you may get. I mean, if you're going to get where you have risk of military coups and riots is from that side of the aisle. It's not going to be from Trump. The Arizona and Georgia would be the easiest. Georgia was the most sensible state to flip first. That's why I was there, because if they just did a signature match check, they would have more invalid ballots than they did the margin of victory. The next one would be Arizona because it's the second closest margin. The third would be Wisconsin because it's the third closest margin. Then after that, Pennsylvania and Nevada. Pennsylvania, because they systematically allowed illegal votes and everybody knows they really didn't do a signature match check because the Secretary of State said don't discard a ballot based on a signature match check. So I presume they followed that instruction. And in Nevada, 8 out of 9 forged signatures that a reporter sent in, Nevada said were just fine. So we know that their system was a crock. And in Nevada, they were sending the most ballots went out in Nevada. That's where the most, you know, the currency of elections are ballots. And the key is to have strict custody over them. And they got rid of that in this election by sending out millions and millions and millions of ballots, sometimes to people, well, Nevada, people who hadn't requested them at all. And so the idea that was going to be a check on the process was always kind of ludicrous. And once you remove signature matches, you know, you, like I said, you remove all the guardrails, people are going to go off the side of the road. And this election went off the side of the road real early because we told people, go ahead and speed, and we're going to remove all your guardrails. And so, of course, the response is the result is what it is. As Trump did a great job, his 46-minute presentation is a pretty good summation. He highlights the most ridiculous evidence, the most ridiculous examples of problems. He highlights how systemic it is. He doesn't get too deep into the computers, but he just points out, he says, why should we have computers in our election system? Why can't we just have paper ballots? Maybe it'll take a little longer to count, but it can't take longer than this. That was his point. You know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. They just found another 55. So a Democrat was losing the House seat in upstate New York by 12 votes. And magically, they found 55 votes in the closet. I mean, this is a crock. We wouldn't accept this in any country in the world. 55 votes in the closet. We just missed somehow. How did you miss them?
I was going to say, for someone who wants the executive summary, 3 points to tell their friends. What are the three strongest points of, let's not call it fraud, but irregularities that are the most undeniable, the most incontrovertible that people have to know and have to address?
Well, Scott Adams did a great presentation today. He even put up a whiteboard on how to commit the perfect crime. And he included the disinformation component, the fake news components, he included latches and standing in his presentation. And he said, you know, you create the motive. And the motive is, don't you have a moral obligation to remove Hitler from power, Stalin from power? So you give them the motive. Number two, you give them the level of means like we've never given it to them before. Massive ballots all over the place, and you can send them back. You don't have to request them. You don't have to have a witness notarize them. You don't have to even give photo identification. You can just send them in, and the signature match process won't even occur. You don't even have to send them in directly, so it can't even be traced to you. You can just drop them off at a Dropbox intermediary. So we gave the highest motive to do fraud, the easiest means to do fraud, and the least possibility of getting caught, because the criminal system doesn't care. The civil system, it's too early if you file suit before election. It's too late if you file suit after election. And in the middle of all this, we're going to have a bunch of disinformation campaigns that will distract you from the actual illegality that took place. So the three basics are, if there was no problem with the signature matches, which was the only check left on fraud on this mass mail-in balloting, why won't any of the counties or the states allow a meaningful audit in the, or monitoring of the signature matches? Secondly, if there's no problem with the ballots, why won't they publish them to the world, since they're all digitized in most of these states, and they promised they would show them to the world? Why won't they show any of them to the world if there's no problem with the ballots? And a third, if the entire election process was on the up and up, then we should want an open, transparent, monitored process to take place. If there was nothing illicit they were doing when they were counting these ballots, why do they systematically exclude monitors from meaningfully observing what happened? So that's my view. If there's nothing to hide, why are they hiding? There's nothing to lie, why are they lying?
Okay, now, but that's going to be the argument, and that'll be the argument, but the actual... I think there's three pieces of evidence that people are talking about, in particular the what was it? It was the 200,000 vote jump, the graph now that is people's avatar, which is the blue and then like that. Is there any explanation that has been given for that other than a computer glitch?
No, I mean, the official explanation is that they reported at the same time, that they were really counting all the way through, but that Edison's reporting mechanism is that the statistical anomaly reflects how Edison reported it with the New York Times, the published information, not how the counting was actually conducted. That's the effect, and that they were only counting ballots that were heavily Biden ballots simply because they were absentee ballots late pursuant to state law in some of these cases. So that's the official explanation from the Democratic media law Twitter side of the aisle. There are still issues, because as the president pointed out, they're just unprecedented reporting. And as we've never had this ballot, this number of ballots reported for this candidate in these states in the history of presidential elections. So it's like, did the absentee balloting process somehow compel that to occur? And my counter to that also is this: people like me shouldn't have been able to predict it before the election. We said, look, if there's something wrong with the election, Democratic counties are going to hold back their ballots and report them after all the Republican counties have voted, and they'll report massive amounts. And that's why I was on our locals chat board was telling people, now it's probably not a bad time to sell. But this was, before, because it was clear there was a ballot discrepancy taking place. Now, even I didn't think they would do what they did, or however they counted them the way they did. But again, from the statistical anomalies are all over the place. I mean, apparently we have final results from New York City, and Trump did about 10 points better almost throughout New York City in margin. And yet he did 20 points worse in Atlanta. I mean, this is just why? How? I mean, these groups in Atlanta are supposed to be mimicking and mirroring what New Yorkers are doing. Why are they going 30 points in a different direction? So that there are, and you have all those statistical anomalies that went over with Richard Barris, in the sense of all the bellwether counties were trending Trump, and yet somehow for the first time in 60 years, they were all wrong. You see neighboring communities in Eastern Ohio and Western Pennsylvania going in opposite directions. Haven't seen that in 60, 70 years. In many cases, haven't seen it ever. Usually people cite 1960 because that was all about whether you were Catholic or Protestant in terms of how you were voting in that election. But for almost all of our history, these places, like places, trend alike. Somehow not in 2020. So there are tons of statistical anomalies to still show. But in terms of persuasive direct evidence, the best evidence is still in the state's custody and possession. Well, do the signatures match? Do the ballots look clean? Were there problems with the machines? Those three things are only in their possession. We can just guess at them based on the unusual anomalies we've seen in this election. I mean, this election was historically unprecedented at like 35 different levels. First time an incumbent has improved, and Trump improved by record numbers, 20% increase of a raw votes from one election to the next, and yet somehow lose? That hasn't happened in American history. So, I mean, there's a ton of things that have never happened that are historically unprecedented statistically, historically. In this election that are indicia of something unusual occurring. But the best evidence is they won't allow us to see the ballots, and they won't allow us to see the signatures, and they won't allow us to see the machines.
All right. Now, Joe W. says, I'll try again. And I want you to tell people, because the people who don't know better or don't watch enough don't know. What is Attorney Barnes doing to help us with the suits? Is he representing any plaintiffs in any electoral fraud cases? What you can tell us publicly, obviously.
Sure. Yeah. So the president personally asked me to help several weeks ago. So I've been helping all along. I've been donating almost all of my time and trying to help strategically and help direct litigation and help develop strategy. And you probably saw him today. If you did see him today, you saw his focus was a lot on the strategic arguments that I have been making all the way through and that he saw as the strongest arguments all the way through. So that's the key issues. If there's no problem with the signatures, let us see them. If there's no problem with the ballots, let us see them. If there's no problem with the machines, let us take a little look. That's it. Not asking for anything more, anything different, anything else. When every legal ballot to count, no illegal ballot to count, because every illegal ballot that counts dilutes the value of every legal ballot that was cast. And so he's understood that. He's reiterated that. He's reinforced that. The problems he's faced, the hurdles he's faced, is that the institutional establishment lawyers who are supposed to be representing him were often lying to him and were often conflicted, either because they don't really like him or because they represent high-ranking Republican officials who are embarrassed by how this election was conducted because they were often culpable in how it was done. The legislatures of Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Arizona are all partially responsible for the disaster that took place here. Election officials, either governors or secretaries of state, and many of them are Republican in several of these states, also equally culpable. The lawyers spent most of their time covering for them and trying to coerce a concession out of Trump rather than do the job. Second obstacle is the only lawyers he really trusts are lawyers he's personally known for a long time. Given the nature of this kind of contest. And the problem is those lawyers have wanted to run the show themselves, frankly. And so I volunteered my time. So anybody could, and I did a lot of work for several weeks to make it happen. A lot of other lawyers did too, by the way. There's some great people working behind the scenes. The hurdle has been on the opposite side. Rudy wants to do his own thing. I mean, it's that simple. And the other obstacle is that Sidney and Wood want to do their own thing. And that they've been told that there were problems with what they were pursuing. So Rudy's a good PR guy. I respect Rudy's loyalty to Trump. He should have brought in several election contest lawyers. He chose not to. So that's the reality of where it's at. And it's not just me. I mean, Harmy Dillon could have been included. He didn't. He chose not to. He's including people that he knows. And I understand that in part. But if you don't have election lawyers that have been through this, that don't understand how elections work. Here's the other thing. It's not just about me one way or the other. Richard Barris should have been, I told them from day one, hire Richard Barris. Other people that were key, good lawyers in the room told them to hire Matt Brainerd right away, begging daily that these people get hired, and they weren't. So this is because Rudy wants to run his own show, Sidney wants to run her own show, and Trump's kind of caught in the middle, and he's doing the best he can. But you know, they've decided to do their own thing. And so it's not because people aren't volunteering that any weakness is showing up in their presentations. It's because they've chosen to exclude anyone else from the room that they didn't want there. And that's just their protocol. And, you know, I was mostly mute about this for the first several weeks. But as I've seen the problems start to reoccur, I've decided to be more and more public about it, not disclosing any of my attorney-client communications that I had with anybody in the room, but disclosing what was not attorney-client protected. I mean, because the whole time in Georgia, I was there in the room with the Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, and others made explicit promises to him and to us in that room that then were not kept a couple of days later and weeks later. And so I've just grown tired with it. Made the point about Sonny Perdue on Twitter yesterday, because bottom line is a lot of these people owe loyalty to Sonny Perdue, and Sonny has not used that loyalty to help the president who put him in the cabinet, for crying out loud. So the president is simply, it's the core weakness all the way through, which is a populist movement needs institutional support. He doesn't have any. And so consequently, it's very tough to overcome institutionalized opposition of this kind. And I've laid out a path that I thought could get you there. And the president has liked that path and has pursued that path. But some other people that are on the legal team have gone their own way. And they have sort of exclusive, the president's not a lawyer. And he has to pick someone to run the show. And those people that are running the show have their own objectives and have their own pursuits. And I've made clear where my disagreements were. So but I've helped and I've continued to help behind the scenes other people that are still bringing their own parallel actions, whether in Pennsylvania and Arizona or Nevada or Georgia. So it's not the case that I'm sort of armchair quarterbacking, second guessing whatever else is anybody else is doing while being unwilling or unable to throw my own hat in the ring. You know, I had that there were clients I gave up in exchange for doing this over the last 3 weeks. So I've put personal capital, personal effort, personal time, personal reputation into it of extensive and expansive scale. And, you know, because someone like, you know, certain, you know, the president asks you personally to do it, you say yes. And I've been very loyal. He's been very loyal to the communities where I come from. So I'm going to return the favor. But his biggest hurdle is not the fact that he maybe doesn't have the best team defending him in certain arenas. His biggest hurdle is that he just has judges and politicians who don't want to help him. That's his big hurdle. And how to overcome that in a short time period is something I've always said is going to be uphill. Doesn't mean it can't be done. Doesn't mean you shouldn't try, but it's why in four more years, he'd be far more stronger if he built a real institutional infrastructure like Andrew Jackson did to make meaningful, lasting change. I know people don't want to hear that. They want to hear we're going to win now. But I think realistically, you have to have that as a backup.
Yeah, no, people don't think there's going to be anything to salvage in 4 years' time if things go the way they're going. I won't share my skepticism or optimism on that. Two things. Brought up a super chat before, which said that the voting machines in Georgia have already been wiped. Is that
true? There's claims of that, but I don't think that's actually going to turn out accurate. So the judge did issue a partial injunction on several of the counties to make sure they preserve it. But there's a federal law that requires they keep a wide range of evidence for 22 months about any election. So that would be a serious problem if they actually did do that. I will be surprised if they actually did do that under the circumstances. But you can't rule anything out. And it would raise questions. I mean, my biggest thing was not algorithmic manipulation from a foreign location. The problem with these machines is you break up the chain of custody of paper ballots. And you can print out, duplicates. You can print out test ballots that look exactly like a regular ballot. Now, where that would pop up is the serial number would be off in sequencing. That's why I was like, hey, would you guys just publish the ballots like you said you were? I mean, I was being low key when I first came in, and they were like real curious. Why exactly do you want that? It's like, oh, you know, he said he would do it 2 years ago. It'll help everybody get confidence. We can get past all this. And they just played games for 4 or 5 days. And my guess is they checked themselves and they found something wrong. You have people like this Gabriel Sterling going out, who's an official with the Georgia Secretary of State's office. He follows a bunch of Never Trumpers on his Twitter feed. By the way, if you're going to pretend to be a Trump patron, make sure you purge your Twitter feed of all the things you've liked in the past, Gabe, and other people like this. People connected to him and representing him lied to me for weeks, so I got zero patience for him. But you know they're up to something when they do the politician victim scam. They come out and they say, oh, all this criticism has led to all these nasty, mean emails and voicemails. So if you would just stop criticizing me, then all these nasty death threats and everything else would go away. And it's like the problem isn't the death threats, which is you can be easily investigated in person, easily punished and prosecuted for. The problem is your fraud. And that's the reason why people are upset at you. And it's a pure scam when you say you can't criticize me for fraud because then maybe some crazy person will handle it incorrectly. That's a politician scam. It's trying to shift who the victim is. And it was amazing watching all these people run to his embrace. The fact that he's even doing such press conferences should tell you, okay, rather than just simply address with the issues, he's saying you can't question me or people will say mean things about me and crazy people will say even crazier things. You know, take a look at what Trump's regular threats are on an hourly basis. Then talk about worrying about threats. So that's just more evidence that these people are not honest, not straightforward. Know that they're not. I experienced it for weeks while I was down there. And the pitch all along was, hey, don't worry. We have special relationships. We have, and I should have known from my criminal defense days that that's always a lie. We have special relationships. Play nice. Don't say anything public. And we'll make sure everything gets done. And we're going to deputize people connected to your office to look at all the signatures to make sure they're done right and double check the ballots. And yeah, we're going to be printing those ballots. And all they were doing was slow playing, waiting for Sydney and Lynn to appear and make it all sound crazy so they could not do anything.
I did a video a while back in the early stages of the vlog, you know, my five red flags for problem clients or deceitful clients. And you know, one of them was always promising stuff for the future, like we're gonna do this, we're gonna do that. It's always an indication they're trying to pull the wool over your eyes in real time. And it's sure as sugar, to use my old expression. Okay, hold on. There was another question. The signatures have been verified. I brought up someone's comment before because that's a common talking point. They say in Georgia, they've already verified. They've done the hand recount. Explain to someone why it is that the hand recount that they have done or purported to have done doesn't actually address the real issue.
So I was down there. A lot of those early letters that were being sent out were drafted by me. Now, there was additional components in there. I mean, where Lynn Wood and Sidney Powell have a point is that high-ranking Republican officials in Georgia were saying, don't touch Dominion from day one. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense. But so there's clearly issues there. But putting that aside, I thought the better election issues were and the better evidentiary issues were the signature match check. They agreed they would do a re-canvass, an audit, and a recount all at the same time. And he publicly went out and said it. And so I was like, okay, good. He's actually going to deliver. And for people who don't know, the United States Elections Assistance Commission, set up after the 2000 election and 2002 legislation by Congress, established best practices guides. You can look this up online yourself. The Election Integrity Project did the same thing. And they include what is supposed to be in a canvas. And a re-canvas is just the same, is just doing the canvas a second time. The same thing as they say what should be in a count. A recount is just the same thing as a count a second time. Only question is whether it's by machine or by manual or both. And an audit is making sure, for example, you don't have more votes than voters. It's making sure that you've accounted for all the votes. It's making sure there's no discrepancies between precincts. It's so that you don't have 55 ballots show up at 3 weeks later in a closet in New York that could change the outcome of an election after all the counting and recounting is done.
Someone asked, who put the ballots in the closet, Robert? Do we know?
Exactly. Or, you know, it's how you have. And here's how they used to do it in the old days. You always had a bunch of ballots filled out in different places. And the reason why you wait until the last minute is you figured out how many boxes you needed to pull out of the closet. You leave the others in there. You don't steal any more than you gotta. And so that's the old scam. And to watch it in live time, at least the external evidence of it, how could Richard Barris and I predict it for 3 months? But, you know, if on election night at 4 a.m., you have a bunch of Democratic counties that haven't reported yet in big key swing states, that means a bogus vote is about to happen. And yet exactly that happened. And that's how these things occur. But when an audit checks against that, an audit checks the technology, checks the computers, make sure that, for example, that when they did test ballots before the election on election night, that they actually spoiled those ballots and didn't keep them around. Things like that. Didn't disguise them as absentee ballots when they weren't really. And things like that. So a bunch of things like that. That's what he promised he would do. And then within days, it became clear in Georgia, they did no re-canvass at all. A canvas is supposed to include a signature match check. It never happened. They didn't even double check the signatures themselves. They didn't even claim to do so. Least of all, allow it to be independently monitored. They did no meaningful audit. And then the manual recount, they didn't allow anybody to monitor. They said, yeah, I mean, one person brought binoculars to try to figure out what was going on. And so that's how bad it was.
Now, and this drives me nuts because it's another one of the talking points that you see on Twitter. You were engaging with the individual, I forget who it was, basically saying, you know, the court said that they were able to observe. And you're quoting, I think it's in Pennsylvania, where the judge effectively said, your right to observe doesn't guarantee you the right to meaningfully observe. And nobody knows it because nobody read the decision. All you have is a judge saying you had the right to, you were authorized to observe, dismissed. And people don't know this. So a canvas is supposed to cross-check the signatures on the ballot to the signature on what exactly again?
The signature on the absentee envelope to the signature that's in the file, which is either a voter registration card, a prior absentee ballot application, or the driver's license, whichever is most recent.
Okay. And that doesn't tell you who they voted for. That just tells you whether or not the signature on the absentee, on the request, and on the ballot themselves match. So there's no violation of privacy here. It just tells you if the signatures match. And if they don't match, so I guess this is the question. If they don't match, you don't know for whom they don't match, right? But you can know based on the proportion of mail-in ballots to Biden. If 10% didn't match, proportionately, that would impact Biden however many more times he got mail-in ballots.
And the legal rule is that you just assume that ballot went to the winner. And it's not that they switch who won. They say the election outcome is now in doubt. That's the legal terminology. So they you never have to prove in an election contest who somebody voted for, because they protect secrecy and anonymity of the ballot. So you only have to prove that there were illegal ballots cast, number one, and number two, that those illegal ballot, the number of illegal ballots cast exceed the margin of victory. Those are the only two facts you have to prove. Now, and the traditional remedy is a new election. But in this context, the likely constitutional remedy is the House decides by state delegation.
Okay, fascinating. And the I brought this super chat up, and I think it comes into one of the questions I wanted to ask. I'm gonna go for this question, then I'm gonna add my question. I think one L here means first year law, probably. Big fan of you guys. Wanted to know what chances are of the Supreme Court granting certiorari on either the case about the Pennsylvania constitutional amendment or the case against Bookvar. And then when you after you answer that, the question is going to be, what is the impact that they've attributed judges to different states? And what does that mean? Because I don't think I understand that. But starting with this one.
So the Supreme Court has plenty of capacity to make a decision. So there's a potential remedy in Wisconsin Supreme Court where an original, because the other thing that happened this week was the Thomas More Society, the Amistad Project by the former Attorney General of Kansas, who has brought actions in Wisconsin and Michigan, maybe now Pennsylvania. I know he's looking at Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada as well. There's a very good election contest in Nevada, very good election contest in Arizona, about to be a very good election contest in Georgia. The president has filed a challenge in Wisconsin. The president, I believe, is going to be filing a challenge in Michigan. And then there's some audit lawsuits in Michigan. So there are good suits out of all these cases and places where there can be remedy either at the local court level or SCOTUS. For the Supreme Court, there's all this talk out there that the U.S. Supreme Court would never, ever take these cases. And I find it funny because it's Law and Crime, which is a place I used to write for occasionally. Dan Abrams founded it, has become a left-wing clickbait over the past year. They've hired all these hack reporters like Adam Clansfield and others from Courthouse Reporter, which are just left-wing hacks disguised as legal reporters. And I've been telling them, you know, you can be a left-wing hack, fine, but can you not be as overt about it? Can you at least pretend you're reporting on legal news and not report fake news and not report it in fake ways? Because they take egregious pot shots at people that are just incredulous. But putting that aside, but a lot of them have been saying that, oh, you can't, there's no way SCOTUS will take this case. There's even a SCOTUS blog, which, by the way, is not the official Supreme Court blog. People got confused. There is no Supreme Court official blog. It's a blog that follows the Supreme Court. That's their name on Twitter. And they do really good informed analysis. But they're saying, no, none of these cases are ever going to be taken. Well, I lived through Bush v. Gore. I was a young law graduate, and I was actually slightly on the Gore side. I didn't like the Bushes at all. Gore is from Tennessee. I had family friends that knew it, very close to his family, same part of the state. I wasn't necessarily a big Gore fan, but I would lean more that direction. But it was fascinating to watch as a young lawyer, and I believed that then it should have gone to the House. Now, that would have gone for W. But I thought that's fine. That's the constitutional remedy. Let's set the precedent. And by the way, Ron Klain, the chief legal officer for the Gore reelection effort, for the recount contest effort, agreed with me. And guess who he is now? He's Joe Biden's recommended White House chief of staff. So I'm not saying anything that Biden's would-be White House chief of staff didn't say in 2000. He also, by the way, used to say for the last 20 years, he's been commenting on how easy it is to rig elections, by the way. So
the about faces is suspicious in and of itself. It's in your it is literally like we have always been at war with Eurasia or East Asia. Forget what. And switching mid-sentence 2016 to 2020, the media and the politicians have switched mid-sentence just out completely. Of nowhere.
I mean, and the statistical anomaly evidence is 10 times stronger in this election than it was in 2016. And the historical anomaly evidence is 20 times stronger. And then the actual evidence is 100 times stronger. I mean, almost literally. They didn't have affidavits from thousands of people all across the country in key swing states identifying under penalty of perjury election systemic irregularities or illegalities that occurred, like is present here. I mean, our U.S. postal workers willing to risk their job? Are UPS workers willing to risk their job? Are all these people willing to risk their futures by coming out publicly and saying what they saw?
Talking about reprisal threats, knowing the way the social media mob goes after people who do this. And this is actually right on the point of the super chat. Timothy Scover says, has the truck driver's claim in the Amistad project been debunked? He claims to have taken ballots from New York to Pennsylvania. What's up with that?
So I've heard no rebutting of that. I was curious to hear the rebutting. And this is where I'm not fond of campaigns that go in more extravagant directions. What the media is doing is they're focusing almost exclusively on what Powell and Wood are saying. And they're ignoring what comes out of a lot of these hearings. They're ignoring what's coming out by at the press conference with the whistleblowers by the Amistad Project. They're ignoring what's happening in some of these lawsuits. You haven't really heard about the Nevada election contest that's about to have an evidentiary hearing in court. Most people haven't. Most people haven't heard that Kelly Ward won her initial challenge with the court to get to inspect signatures and duplicate ballots, and that when she did, she found systemic irregularity already in just the duplicate ballot section. Why? Because it's a lot easier. By the way, and this was part of Scott Adams' presentation today. He says one key to committing the perfect crime is you lead in a lot of disinformation so people can't track who committed the crime and where the crime was. It's great analysis by Scott. I'll give him credit. He would have been a great lawyer. So we'll see. But yeah, so there's substantial evidence in all these different places. But SCOTUS has every – I lived through it. And the – well, you know what all the Democrats were saying? And you can read books like Versus Goliath by David Boies, who I respect his tactical skill, not a fan of some people he gets associated with, another story. But he magically shows up in ways that protect the system after 2000. From Enron to that scam out in California on the blood DNA stuff, how it was going to cure you. But so but in it, he goes through, none of them thought the U.S. Supreme Court was going to take Bush v. Gore. It was a pure state election contest filed solely under state law, had no U.S. constitutional issues really raised at all within it, no U.S. statutory issues really raised within it. So that's what they thought. Of course, they thought they were done when they won at the Florida Supreme Court. And I saw tons of Democratic lawyers saying, no chance the U.S. Supreme Court takes it. This isn't a federal issue. This is a federalism issue. And as a federalism issue, is going to stay with the states. And they clearly have never fully, they've forgotten the history of that. And they haven't read through the concurrence that Chief Justice Rehnquist wrote addressing that specific question, saying if it involves the presidency, it's a federal issue. If it involves the safe harbor statute, it's a federal issue. If it involves the Elector's Clause, it's a federal issue. We can always apply due process and equal protection to any election. So they can take any of these cases. The big open question is, will they have the courage to do so? Like I said, throughout, Trump's still right on the law. Trump's still right on the facts. An honest election elects him. It may not yet be eternal truth number three. Eternal truth number one, Sally Yates is corrupt. Eternal truth number two, Epstein didn't kill himself. Eternal truth number three might be an honest election voted Donald Trump in 2020, but we'll see. But they can take it. It's will they have the political courage to do so? That's why I think when you see a Republican Governor Ducey in Arizona step on the Giuliani hearings on Monday and then Barr step on the Michigan hearings on Tuesday, it's the Republican establishment sending a message to the Supreme Court not to get involved. Ted Cruz, to his credit, came out and said they should get involved. Now, of course, all these senators are still weak. Where is the senator on TV every night saying, let's have an honest, transparent election? Where are those nincompoops in Georgia saying, you know what, if you vote for me on January 5th in the runoff, I will object to the electors being certified unless we have an independent investigation into the ethics of the inquiry? That doesn't even commit you to vote a certain way. It just says, I will make sure we have a transparent election and a full investigation, and then you'll get those Trump voters out for you, which right now is a major problem. But when the senators aren't saying anything, the governors aren't saying anything, the state legislative leaders are not saying anything, it's sending a message to the Supreme Court that they may actually hear. And that's the problem. So it's a purely a political decision. They have every legal right and every legal opportunity to take the case. If they had moral courage, they would take it. But whether they do is an open question.
All right. And now I guess that's on the same line. What does it mean when we've heard or we've seen this graph or diagram that Supreme Court justices have been attributed to specific states?
That doesn't really mean anything. So technically the we have circuits because a court used to ride circuit. So the Supreme Court, each of the judges used to be ahead of their circuits. There were no circuit courts at the beginning of the country. In fact, you even had Supreme Court justices do trials. That's how one of them got impeached, was how he handled that trial. So the and then we created circuit courts, but that name still came from that old history of the Supreme Court's quote unquote writing circuit. We still have that in some state systems in the country today, though that's mostly gone because we've put judges at every we have more and more judges, more and more judges. So the but now the what they have is they still preside over different circuits. And theoretically, they can grant stays or injunctions, and they have emergency and relief authority as the sole justice over that circuit. And back in the old days, justices like Black and Douglas really used that power to fantastic effect. But when Rehnquist came in, he effectively coerced the rest of the court to agree to transfer any case that comes into them as the emergency relief presiding over that region to refer it to the entire court. So it is it's very rare these days for them to do anything other than that. So when people saw that, they inferred that it meant something more than it likely does. It's just because they added a justice, they were going to reapportion the circuits. So that was always going to happen. And who got the circuits they got was about the norm and about as expected, but it likely doesn't mean anything in terms of the election because it's highly unlikely they will rule unilaterally without the other without referring it to the entire court.
Okay, and I think this may be the biggest celebrity we've ever had in our chat. Steve Buscemi's here. If that is your real name, Steve. Robert Viva, Kelly Ward of Asgop found 2 out of 100 Dup ballots that were altered removed from the Trump. AZ is back in play. Do you think this could cause a cascade?
It was the first big win, and it was critical. She first was filing the election contest. Second was, and we had people lined up to file it in case she didn't. And they borrowed from our language. They borrowed from our remedies. And that was fantastic to see. It's interesting. For all the establishments bashed Kelly Ward more than anyone in Arizona, but she's the only one to have any political IQ in that state. While they've been putting up nimrods like Martha McSally, who managed to lose twice. I mean, that's how good the GOP establishment is. They don't just lose once. They lose back to back. That should be their name to fame. If they had a T-shirt, that would be what it was. The back-to-back losers. So going to that, that was a huge win right out of the gate. So smart to file it where? State court. What procedural posture? Election contest. Why does that matter? Gives you an automatic right to inspect ballots in Arizona where the judge has very little authority to deny it. What does the judge do? He says, yeah, I'm going to let you sample duplicate ballots. That's where you say there's a problem. I'm going to let you sample signatures to see where if that's a problem. And we'll know if there's a problem by if you get a statistically significant response. And he didn't require it to be a big number. He just said 100 duplicate ballots, 200 signatures. Well, she gets 100 duplicate ballots. And in just that 100, they failed to count 2 Trump ballots. Now, what does that mean? That's 2%. So that means you multiply that times other duplicate ballots, you probably have more than the 10,000 margin of victory in the state, which is 0.2% or 0.3% of the entire statewide vote.
That's amazing. Now, I think this question is on point. Also, Tom Villa says, if an objection is raised in the House, is any senator likely to second the objection? My guess would be Rand Paul. Does that mean an objection to certification?
I have 2 problems with that. The first one is the Constitution says in a contested election or whenever there is doubt about whether an Electoral College majority was formed, that goes to the House by state delegation. In 1887, they passed a law to try to overturn that somehow, but it's not a constitutional amendment. And it's only that law that says we're only going to consider an election contest to be present if a member of the House and a member of the Senate both object, and then they meet for 2 hours, and then they come back and they vote, and you have to get both the majority of the House and a majority of the Senate not voting by state delegation, or it's not contested. Well, that completely guts the 12th Amendment. To me, that violates the 12th Amendment. Somebody smart should challenge. Maybe I'll talk to Gosar or one of the others. Somebody should challenge that because I don't think that's constitutional. In other words, if you set up a constitutional amendment and it says, if in the case of a contested issue, here's who decides and here's how, but then you remove from that very body the power to decide whether or not it's contested in the first place, you've completely gutted the amendment. It no longer means anything. You just say, you know what? The power to decide whether it's contested is now done in a different manner. We, Congress, unilaterally assert power over that, even though the 12th Amendment says otherwise in the case of a contested election. So I have problems with that. But the second one is currently the way that if that statute is followed and nobody holds it's unconstitutional, then, yes, you have to have a member of the House and a senator mutually object to the certification of the electors. And what happens then is then the House and the Senate discuss it, debate it for 2 hours, come back, vote, and you have to get a majority of both branches object or those electors count. Now, there's another theory, which is that the vice president can unilaterally just say different electors. I guarantee Democrats were pitching this, by the way, in 2000. High-ranking law professors were pitching this in 2000. Now they've all gone mute. You know, they're like, I don't know what you're talking about. But, you can't erase law review articles.
It's a shame social media was not the same thing back then. There'd be much more evidence of it today. People would be going, deleting their accounts entirely. Okay, so it's, I mean, what are we looking for this week now? What's going to be the next things to look for?
So my understanding is there's going to be a hearing in Arizona, an evidentiary hearing before a court on the election contest. Let's see if based on the signature, do they find problems with the signatures? I'm hoping that they got a fair sample. And if so, then the court should order a massive signature match check of the entire state and a duplicate ballot check of the entire state. And Trump may be in the game to offset Arizona. And if he, and as you noted earlier, if he gets one state, all of a sudden that changes the story, changes the script, changes momentum. It'll be harder for the Supreme Court to stay out. It'll be harder for Congress to stay out. It'll be harder for state legislatures to stay out. So that will be a very big decision. Another real big one this week will be an evidentiary hearing, I believe, tomorrow in Nevada. I believe both of those evidence. I believe the evidentiary hearing in Arizona is happening tomorrow. I believe the evidentiary hearing in Nevada is happening tomorrow. That, too, that's one of the better presented cases. You know, Adam Laxalt is part of that, the ex-attorney general. Rick Grinnell is part of that, and from a court of public opinion perspective. And so hopefully they establish tomorrow all these people who illegally were registered to vote and the same signature match problem. And if they do, you may see a reversal of momentum. Both of those are the best opportunity to see a reversal of momentum. You'll see it, there's hearings going on today in Michigan. There's talks that they may have hearings later in the week, public hearings, Giuliani hearings in Thursday or Friday in Wisconsin. We'll see if that goes forward. They, I believe, will be filing an election contest Thursday or Friday in Georgia. I believe there's going to be a signature match request made in Georgia with one of the election contests that is going to be filed. And so I think that I'm optimistic on that as well. So if signature matches get ordered and if they come back problematic, as has already happened in Arizona, at least being ordered and duplicate ballots not matching in the ways that they were recorded as matching, that really opens the door to it's Trump's best shot. He needs some momentum to counter. He's had good momentum with these public hearings, but he needs more momentum to try to put pressure on SCOTUS. And does SCOTUS take, if SCOTUS needs to take a case within the next week? And, you know, maybe they could reject these emergency relief requests from the Pennsylvania, and that would be a problematic indicator, or maybe they take one. And if they take one, that's a positive indicator. So so we'll have big news this week, one way or the other.
And, the question is then, what would be the best question for the Supreme Court to take? Would it be the constitutionality of the mail-in ballot procedure, which might only affect one state? Like, what question could they address that would?
I think they should approach it from a global perspective, that if we have elections in doubt because a lot of ballots were cast illegally in violation of either state law, federal law, the Constitution, equal protection, whatever the analysis may be, they need to start prepping the country for the constitutional remedy of the House dictating the election, saying these elections are clearly in doubt. We had a bunch of states who had ballots cast in violation of their own state constitution, their own state law, that either were done by election boards unilaterally or secretaries of state unilaterally or governors unilaterally or state legislatures, but in violation of their own constitutional constraints on how legislation passes. In ways it may have violated equal protection, in ways it may have led to voter dilution, and just say that aggregately the solution for this is that the House decides the election. The election is in doubt in enough of these states and they could do that procedurally in almost a quasi Pontius Pilate way by simply enjoining the certification from going forward until there's full evidentiary hearings at the lower court below, knowing that it's unlikely those evidentiary hearings will get factual resolution prior to the safe harbor deadline passing for the Electoral College in December 8th. And that would be another way of forcing it to the House. But I think that's what they should establish, that when we have doubts about the election, when an election was done in an irregular, unconstitutional manner, that the remedy is to send it to the U.S. House of Representatives to decide by state delegation. And if they have the courage of their convictions, that's what they do. If they are, if they're true constitutional originalists, as they have been promised to be, that's what will happen. I again say that's a big hurdle, because some of these people are much more committed to their cocktail club than they are the Constitution.
Well, and this actually, I'm just bringing up a Karen Strand question, says, wouldn't it be hilarious if the House picks Trump and the Senate after the runoffs picks Harris? The but now on the subject of that, Owen Jones says, Robert, do you think lawyers who are sympathetic to Trump should form a counter to Federalist Society establishment? You've met the good ones through this crisis. Is Falk a good home? Free America Law Center, a good home to form law support for populists as part of a Jackson building.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that we definitely need something like that. I mean, I co-founded Free America Law Center to help provide a counterpoint to the ACLU to support populist civil rights and civil reform in our election system and across the board, to protect speech, to protect self-defense, to protect the right to privacy, to protect the right against state intrusion, forced vaccines, lockdowns, you name it. So it's a great idea that Owen has and that others have also mentioned. And I'm looking at it would probably be best to create it as a separate group, a separate society of just lawyers that are dedicated to populist causes that are aligned across the country. Because people reach out to me all the time and say, oh, you know, I need a lawyer, say, in Montana. It's not a case that's necessarily, you know, warrants or, you know, needs an out-of-state lawyer. Do I know somebody? And in many, and I know a good number, so I'm often able to help, but it would be great to know a lot more, to form a counterpoint and counterpart to the Federalist Society, because we're seeing the deleterious and detrimental effects of their monopoly on appointment power and how many bad decisions have come from their members so far. And if SCOTUS fails to take action, they will deserve a lot of the blame for recommending the people that are on that bench. They recommended 6 of the 9.
Okay, fascinating. And now also, I keep messing this name. Theophrastus returns. I think CNN would prefer Trump hatred for 4 years instead of kissing Biden's bottom until 2024. They know the laptop is real. So this is a funny thing I've been thinking in my head. If CNN and Fox News start appreciating that they may very well go belly up in a Biden presidency, within the next month, you could have a massive change in the narrative where things start popping up, stories start being focused, and it would be cynically hilarious if that's the turn it took, because these media companies realize they won't survive a boring 4 years.
I don't think they will, but I think that the interesting thing about the professional class has been their willingness to sacrifice personal profit for power, that they would rather have the power to defeat their adversaries than they would monetarily do well. Like CNN has made decisions that are economically counterproductive. Fox right now is making decisions that are economically counterproductive. But you know, it seems like they're willing to, or being able to, shape the future of society in the image they want. So I think that's where that's come about. But no, if they actually cared about money, then a Trump comeback is the best thing for them.
Poor Viva. Oh, Khabib is back in the house. Oh, we have Khabib Nurmagomedov. I keep messing up his last name. And Steve Buscemi. It's a great, very star-studded stream tonight, Robert. Is Barnes traveling out of state in the next 7 to 14 days?
If needed and called in. So there's a good – the Arizona, they got good lawyers. I believe they're going to have good lawyers in Georgia. I've said I'm available for anyone who needs me for any of these election contests to appear. Almost all these court hearings are being done by Zoom, so you don't have to fly anywhere anymore. That was for in-person meetings with the Secretary of State's representatives for those 2 weeks, and the campaign people and the rest. And there's a great disappointment in how the RNC has mishandled this badly. They've misdirected funds badly. Almost nobody in even the data team in Georgia is even helping the Trump team. It's disgraceful what's happened down there. But you know, that ship has kind of sailed. So, but I'm willing to go anywhere, any place. That's the promise I made to from the very beginning.
Amazing. And now, Mr. Hunt, we've had a lot of funny names in addition to the celebrity names. How did a lawyer get to this point? How did we get to this point? By mainstream media, big tech, by your own party disenfranchising all of us with blatant disregard, shutting us up, deleting us, and fraud right in front of our eyes. Fraud, statistically and actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary. And that's what my point to the establishment types was when I first got there. I mean, I wanted to slow play it because I figured if they knew the consequence of what I was arguing for, they would double down on trying not to do it. I said, look, you can just put this to rest right away. You know, I mean, 2/3 of Trump's base will be okay with the outcome if they see a transparent process that produces confidence in it. Trump will be okay with it. And since, you know, that's who sent me there, they knew that was the case. So, and yet they still didn't. And frankly, that's when my suspicions went way up. I suspected I was right, but I didn't think I'd be able to prove it. I thought it'd be, you know, because there's so many other ways to steal absentee ballots with and still have legitimate signatures. You can just bribe the person for their vote. I mean, as we now know was actually being done. These idiots kept their Facebook videos up there saying, we'll give you as much as $250 if you voted, knowing they were targeting Democratic voter groups to do that. I mean, they were just buying votes out in the open. And does anyone think that didn't happen on a much broader scale with people who weren't dumb enough to record it on Facebook? The Secretary of State's trying to cover his rear now in Georgia by finally investigating Stacey Abrams' group. My guess is it's like FBI Durham style investigation. We'll get right around to it until it no longer matters, and then we'll go home and sleep.
All right, I think we should cut it at 2 hours for a couple of reasons. So we have something to talk about Sunday, and also full disclosure: Nate Brody is going live at 9 o'clock, and I don't want to overlap with Nate and everybody who has not had enough law talk for the evening. Go over to Nate Brody's channel right now. He's going to go live. He's talking about it's not quite election lawsuits. It's Tati Westbrook. There's a defamation lawsuit. It's an interesting story for anybody who's not familiar with it. Let's see if we get a few more questions before we have 7 minutes, 6 minutes. Is there anything you wanted to mention? I think we got to a lot of the stuff, but definitely not all of it. Is there anything specific you want to mention before we go?
No, I mean, I think there's good evidence everywhere. The hereistheevidence.com has a good aggregation of it. There's other aggregations, other places. If you go to People's Pundit Daily, he has a publication that keeps up a lot of data. He's doing YouTube daily. He's going to be doing a poll to measure what do people really want. Do people want honestly open, transparent process? Or are they like, hey, we're past it, let's move on. And he's going to do it in the states where the issues are contested. And so I think my guess, you're going to see 2/3, 70, 75, 80%. You're going to see a bunch of Democrats saying, no, we want an honest process. We want a transparent process. We want an open process. What the president called for today, he first put out there, he said, we need to just go to paper ballots. He's going to poll that question. My guess is most people say, yes, I'd prefer paper ballots. And we put up on the locals board different because I think the next step of this is election reform. And we should come up with as many good ideas as possible to form templated legislation, talking to Richard Barris about forming a election integrity project for the United States as sort of a center that's dedicated to these issues, that aggregates these issues, that gets all of the empirical evidence, that the statistical surveys, all the commission reports. I've been putting a lot of this up on the locals board so people can see the source documentation, see what the Election Integrity Project said a re-canvas should look like. See what, I mean, these were, by the way, the Secretary of State initially folded because he was accustomed to dealing with people who didn't know these things. So I went down and said, look, all I want is what the U.S. Election Assistance Commission said should be done. And all I want is what the Election Integrity Project, and they're like, well, of course, I want to follow with the U.S. election. Oh, of course, yes, absolutely. And then, of course, he weaseled his way out of it. And then he got COVID conveniently, and his wife got it, and he hid out in his little house, his little mansion, wherever that was. So just to avoid meetings. But, you know, maybe it was sincere, but I just found the timing perfectly coincidental. It's like right around the time he'd like to avoid having to deal with people, his wife gets COVID. Ah, yes. It wasn't that nice. So maybe it's all legit. I'm just saying, interesting timing. If I was him, maybe I would have pulled that nonsense.
Lots of coin. Well, it's the other thing is at some point in time, there's just going to the statistical stuff, which is harder to understand. At some point in time, there's just too many things happening at the same time to disregard all of it and just close your eyes and be told to do what you're told and believe what we're telling you. So
there's simple ways they can still restore the confidence of most people in this election. Allow a meaningful, observed, independently confirmed signature match check to occur. Publish the ballots. They already have them all. Why not publish them to the world? It's what the Georgia Secretary of State said he would do in any contested or close election back in 2018 when he wrote a $106 million taxpayer check to Dominion. He said, one of the great things about this is that we will publish all of the ballots to the world because we already have them digitized, and all it'll take is like one little button and boom, the whole world can see all the ballots. What is in those ballots that he's scared to show any of them? Not only did he not digitally publish them to the world, he won't let people meaningfully monitor them when they're doing the hand recounts. So it's like he won't let them monitor them now in the machine recounts. What there's something weird about those ballots. Either the numbering is off, the barcode issues are present, the ballots look weird, they're all, you know, there's all these Biden only ballots. There's something weird in those ballots that he's scared of the world seeing. Otherwise, why do that? So we have very simple remedies. We may start to see some of them implemented, so we'll get to some factual development, at least in some states. Now, Arizona was the state that was the least likely to have major signature match problems because they've done this for a long time. But if a signature match problem shows up in the small sample they got out of Arizona, you can guarantee that signature match is off the charts in Pennsylvania and Georgia, where they have not had the history of Arizona at doing this correctly. So I think, you know, there's still hope. There's still opportunity. And we'll continue. People can go to the locals board. We'll continue to provide content there. And appreciate all the support that's been there. I have been involved, will remain involved, stay involved, and we'll continue to try to do all we can. The hurdle is that institutional power is all arrayed against Trump. The benefit Trump has is he has both the truth and the law and justice all on his side.
And that answers one of the super chats that I brought up before, but the guinea pig is the international time to wind it up. Robert, thank you very much. You want to see Harry? We'll show everybody Harry. This is Harry the guinea pig. A surprisingly cute animal, actually, with a good personality. It's like it's not a dumb animal. It's actually quite smart and has a routine. Robert,
it picked the kale. It picked the kale.
It picked the kale, and this morning it picked carrot over the kale. So it starts squeaking in the morning when it knows that, you know, we're up and it wants some breakfast. It's a smart animal. Okay, everybody, go check out Nate, Robert, an amazing stream as always. We're going to do Sunday again, so we're going to have undoubtedly big stuff to talk about. And we're going to talk about maybe some other developments in the non-election stuff. I'm going to go back and see some of the super chats to make sure.
Yeah, we'll have about a major Democratic lefty lawyer saying it's okay to have slavery as long as you're a corporation before the U.S. Supreme Court this week. So we'll get to discuss that case. There's a major Second Amendment cases that are coming through, Fourth Amendment cases, more government misconduct in the Southern District of New York, where it turned out the prosecutor was married to the defense lawyer so they could listen into all the conversations and failed to disclose that fact. So lots of fun stuff to talk about in addition to whatever's happening on the election front on Sunday.
And that gives you an indication, everybody, as to the homework that I have not yet done that Robert sent to me. So on that note, check Robert out on Twitter, locals, you know where to find us. Robert, thank you very much. Everybody, thank you for the support. Thank you for tuning in. Amazing win, midweek stream. See you on Sunday. Enjoy the rest of the week.